Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. Today, I am pleased to be bringing you an episode of Janssen-sponsored highlights from the recent European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology Congress, otherwise known as EADV. This year marked the 30th anniversary of the EADV Congress, which once again did not disappoint, showcasing the latest innovations in dermatology and venereology through 11 plenary lectures, 8 late-breaking news sessions, and with over 35 participating companies and 77 industry sessions. Hosting today's episode is Professor Matthias Augustin from the Institute for Health Services Research in Dermatology and Nursing at the University Medical Center Hamburg-Eppendorf, Germany. He is joined by Professor Ulrich Rowitz from the Department of Dermatology at the University Medical Center Schwellschwig-Holstein, Campus Kiel, also in Germany. Together, they are going to discuss the Janssen-sponsored highlights from EADV 2021. Over to you, Professor Matthias Augustin.
Welcome, dear colleagues, to the highlights of EADV 2021. This year marked the 30th anniversary of the EADV Congress and once again did not disappoint, showcasing the latest innovations in dermatology and venereology through 11 plenary lectures, 8 late-breaking news sessions, and with over 35 participating companies and 77 industry sessions. My name is Professor Matthias Augustin from the Institute for Health Services Research in Dermatology at the University Medical Center in Hamburg, Germany. And I would like to welcome Professor Ulrich Rowitz from the Department of Dermatology, University Medical Center of Kiel in Germany. And together during this Janssen-sponsored podcast, we will share with you our highlights of EADV 2021. And I can promise you there have been many and we will address the most exciting ones. So one topic, of course, is psoriasis. And first of all, a warm welcome to you, Uli. And my question, what about long-term data of IL-23 blockers? We have seen some new results. How do you feel about them?
Well, thank you, Matthias, for introducing me. Dear colleagues, I'm also happy to share those interesting new data with you that we have seen during the EADV conference. And of course, the question about the long-term results with the IL-23 inhibitors was one of the highlights of this conference, at least for those who are enthusiasts in psoriasis. And there were data, of course, on the Voyage 1 and 2 study program, in particular on the open label extension phase, now with the endpoint after 5 years of treatment. And that's what we as physicians would like to know. How is a drug acting over time? Do we see a lasting response? Is there any evidence for a loss of response? And that's also needed for the shared decision making when we talk with our patients, which drug would probably be the best for the given patient. And the data we have seen for the guselkumab study program are quite promising in relation to the PASI response that we all know about. There is a sustained response after achieving more or less clearance with the PASI 90 or a DLQI of 0 or 1, and that is sustained over the period of 5 years. The proportion of patients that are leaving the study is amazingly low, and this is, I think, a very good news for those who want to go along the paradigm of long-term disease control.
So which results did you find most remarkable? Because I think you have so much experience in clinical care, they need also to fit to your daily practice. Is this something that you found in the data?
Absolutely. First of all, the sustained efficacy with no evidence for a secondary loss of response was one of the highlights of the data that have been shown. But not only this, the combination with the safety aspects, and this is something, for, of course, for our patients over long term, that's very important. And there were posters, for example, on the risk of malignancies and how the observation was with patients who already had malignancies if there was any evidence for recurrence. And to make a long story short, there was no. This also holds true for the risk of infectious episodes through this 5-year, very long period of time. And there was absolutely no evidence, for example, for a cumulative effect of the risk of infections. And there was a look into many of those aspects, such as nasopharyngitis, urinary tract infections, pneumonia, and many more, including data on candida infections, which are, I think, very important. Zoster, for example. And the safety profile was, and I think this word is really like it is, absolutely clean.
Thank you. And I think we are talking about all licensed drugs from the IL-23 groups, right?
Well, I do really think, and thanks for this question, Matthias, that this is a class effect. It's not only for guselkumab, that's also for tildrakizumab and risankizumab, although we have seen the data at this conference mainly for tildrakizumab and guselkumab. And as you know, risankizumab is the newest kid on the block. And for this, we have, let's call it, only 3 years data. But as you said, they are all showing the same profile. And I think with this gives a lot of confidence in this drug class for treating our patients over the long-term run.
So if we could finally come back to your personal experience, and if you inform a patient that you recommend to use an IL-23 blocker, do you name a number what he can expect on in terms of being on the drug? You say with a probability of 80%, you will still have the drug after 5 years? Or how do you do this when you inform your patients?
Well, again, in this scenario of shared decision-making, exactly what you were saying, Matthias, is that I can inform the patient about three major important things. And the first is the patient can expect a high level of likelihood that the drug is effective. So 80 to 90% of the patients will achieve clear or almost clear skin. That's number one. Number two is that, of course, this is going along with a very clean safety profile. So the likelihood of having adverse events is extremely low. And the third point is that these drugs also are quite fast in their onset of activity. So I can talk to the patient saying when we start treatment, so after the first 4 to 8 weeks, you can only see a major improvement of the skin symptoms. And that's, I think, something where the patients are also interested in, and the adherence with the drug is then major improved. And that's something we know about our patients, that they, if they don't experience improvement of their disease, they would lose the intention to take the injections or the pills. And that's very important. And Matthias, you know very well about this issue.
Well, thank you for this personal comment. We have now talked about the first line treatments in terms of biologics for psoriasis, but there have also been some new data for the orals, right?
The oral TYK2 inhibitor that you would probably mention is something that is in discussion over the long, because it's part of the new, I would say, era of Janus kinase inhibitors. TYK2 is something very special, and we may come to this when we talk about news in, for example, atopic dermatitis. The TYK2 inhibitor that is one of the orals that is in development is somewhere in between. From the data we have seen until 1 year, of course, we could see that there is some degree of response, but it is not as high as we have just discussed as compared to the class of the IL-23 inhibitors, for example, or the new IL-17 inhibitors, particularly the one that inhibits IL-17A and F, bimekizumab. My last comment here would be, it would be very interesting to see when the drug comes to market, where the treating dermatologist will see the place of this kind of drugs in the armamentarium of psoriasis treatment. But Matthias, we've now talked about psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis of the skin quite intensively, but how about psoriatic arthritis?
Yes, in fact, this is another, to us, very exciting topic because on a regular basis, we first get the data for plaque type psoriasis from the clinical trials and later on psoriatic arthritis. And of course, since we have such a high value in using the IL-23, but also IL-17 blockers, we need the arthritis data, given that about 20 to 25% of our patients that we see with psoriasis also have active psoriatic arthritis. And luckily, there have been further studies, both on risankizumab and on guselkumab. And if it comes to Risa, there were presented new studies at EADV showing that this drug also effectively works against arthritis with ACR 20 and 50 responses that were largely superior to placebo. And the safety profile for Risa in these PSA patients over 1 year was excellent. Even more, there were presented extended data on guselkumab and psoriatic arthritis, and these were already 2 years' data. And again, it was shown following the one-year data that we saw last year that guselkumab shows significant and highly effective action against psoriatic arthritis measured with ACR 20, 50, and 75. And this holds on for those 2 years long-term extension period. And again, this was accompanied with action against different parameters from arthritis, like the total joint pain and joint swellings, but also if it comes to other new instruments like the BUS dye, which measures also axial involvement, and especially also enthesitis and other special forms of PSA are equally addressed with guselkumab on the long term. So I was impressed by these data, and they confirm what we know from clinical experience that we cover both plaque type psoriasis and arthritis with guselkumab, but to some extent also with risankizumab. Do you think so as well, Uli?
I would like to add a question to you, Matthias. You were just mentioning the many different scores that rheumatologists are using. Like you mentioned the ACR, you mentioned the BUS dye, the DAS28. So according to your experience, a dermatologist who is trying to interpret the data in PSA, what is the best score for him or her to get an impression of the overall power of the drug to control PSA?
Yeah, this is a good question. And if you ask five rheumatologists, you will get different answers from them because there's no single instrument that covers all purposes. But of course, we need to be pragmatic. And if we follow patients over time, I would rather want to have a global measure which measures disease activity. And for this, we cannot add all the single scores, but should really be comprehensive. And as in the SUBEST registry in Germany, we use just one VAS visual analog scale for the pain and one for the overall activity of the disease. And we ask this to both the physician and the patient. And I think over time, this is sufficient. If it comes to very particular problems like enthesitis, we may also have such a global VAS score for that condition rather than using the enthesitis scores, the lead score, which of course also exists, but they have no place in daily practice to my mind.
So psoriatic arthritis bears one component that is very important and impactful from the patient's side, and that's fatigue. Mm-hmm. In your daily practice, Matthias, do you pay attention to data related to fatigue with the different drugs?
Yes. In fact, you're very right. Fatigue is, I think, the second greatest problem to patients with PSA besides of pain. And there are several special fatigue scores, and it's also included in the BUS dye, for example. Again, I would prefer for practice a single score, a VAS or numerical rating scale on fatigue, because if you explain this to the patients, they can well express in the words and understand what fatigue means, this feeling of being without motion, being tired, being without energy. And again, a numerical rating scale, one scale is sufficient, but we should ask actively the patient about this and follow this up in the course of the treatment. And particularly for guselkumab, we have very good data that this is improved and almost healed along the course of treatment.
Well, yeah, thank you, Matthias, for this. I don't know if you have an opinion about topical treatment, given the fact that we have such a range of powerful drugs that can be applied systemically.
Yeah.
Is there still a room for topical treatment?
Uli, you're absolutely right. We are also looking forward to new compounds in terms of topicals. And actually, there has been a presentation on a new of such developments. And this is tapinarof cream. And can you comment on this? Have you read the poster?
Of course, I did, because this is something new from several aspects. First of all, it's, as you said, a new topical. Second, it's a new mechanism of action. It's a modulation of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which is a pathway that is involved in controlling inflammatory cytokine responses. And what was shown in this poster was that there is a degree of response. The response is also maintained over the period of 40 weeks in which this was investigated here. However, there is, of course, the effect as such is definitely much, much less as compared to the new treatment we have available for systemic use. And I'm a bit worried about the price of new topical treatments in comparison to the topical corticosteroids of the fourth generation we are normally using, which work very fine in a way, dermatology controlled. And as you know from other developments, for example, also for atopic dermatitis, if there's any return on, let's say, investment in efficacy is given, And I'm also concerned about the adherence to topicals with our patients. And that would be, with a very expensive topical, probably a waste of money. But I'm interested in your comment to that.
No, absolutely. There needs to be a balance. Either any new compound is largely superior in effectiveness or safety, then it may also cost more. Or otherwise, if it's equal or less, then the price needs to be lower. And this is surely not to be expected with the new upcoming drugs. And so the gold standard, as you say, is last generation steroids, or even on the same level, the fixed combination of vitamin D3 analog and betamethasone. So each of those has a great place in healthcare, and new upcoming topicals for psoriasis surely need to compete with them, both in effectiveness, safety, and the price. Uli, let's come to the last point, because otherwise we were running out of time. But I would love to hear your opinion on the JAK inhibitors. We have seen many data for different indications like atopic dermatitis, alopecia, vitiligo. Do you see the great future that is proposed to them as well, from your personal view?
Well, JAK inhibitors, that's the new magic term, I think, in dermatology. And you can ask the question if this would replace systemic steroids, at least in some diseases. And the data and, of course, the development in multiple dermatological disorders is sort of arguing for this. What we learned is that many diseases from which we thought they were difficult to treat, they may respond to a Janus kinase inhibitor treatment. But we also have to be aware that it's obviously depending on the selectivity of the different compounds that are in clinical development. And there were many posters on whether or not one of the compounds is a JAK1 selective or a pan-JAK, or we just alluded to this as inhibiting TYK2 that was developed for psoriasis. So in summary, yes, I think the potential is very, very large. And the data that were most, let's say, important to me are the data in atopic dermatitis. And in particular, data that show a comparison to the standard of care, I would name it today, dupilumab, regarding the eczema scores and, of course, the itch. And there were, for example, a new development, abrocitinib, that was showing amazingly high clinical response for both for the skin scores with the EASI and for the cessation of itch in these patients, which I regard most important. And I also need to mention this, these drugs seem to have a very quick onset of action. And as we alluded earlier, for patients, this is extremely important, particularly in atopic dermatitis, where they experience a real benefit within a very short period of time. And the primary endpoint of the abrocitinib study that was shown at the AADV, for example, was after 2 weeks. And I think that's a very important time point for our patients with atopic dermatitis.
Absolutely. And I think both the data for abrocitinib, but also the previous for upadacitinib are very promising. And those patients that we have already treated in practice with upadacitinib or even with baricitinib are doing very well. And the question is, we have two different principles of treatment with, on the one hand, the biologicals, atopic dermatitis, and on the other hand, the JAK inhibitors. And the latter having a better chance to go on off drug in a short period of time. Do you think that they may not be used continuously, but in such reactive way, for example, in patients who just have short-term flares?
Well, that's a very important question, Matthias. And that also refers to this benefit-risk ratio. And we know that Janus kinase inhibitors, in principle, are immunosuppressants and not targeted treatments like, for example, dupilumab that was just mentioned. The spectrum of potential adverse events, particularly over long-term run, can only be discussed when we have long-term data. And in this scenario, these stepwise treatment was discussed among experts. And as you said, a start with a fast-acting efficacious drug, such as a JAK inhibitor, or having a quick fix, and thereafter going over to a treatment that was already shown to be long-term safe, such as dupilumab, but there may be others in the group of targeted biologic treatments, then for the long-term run. And I think this strategy is tempting, but we need to have data that allows to judge if this really is something to go for or whether there are problems related to the transition period.
Do you think that, like in psoriasis, we also still have a great importance of the topicals in atopic dermatitis also in the future, and maybe even need for upcoming new compounds?
Well, I think that the need for topicals is even more pronounced in atopic dermatitis as in psoriasis. And that's also due to the fact that the patient population is very different. We have more children and young adults in the atopic dermatitis spectrum as we have in psoriasis. And of course, for those, the safety aspect is very different to judge. But there have been developments, and they were shown also in the AADV spectrum of atopic dermatitis posters, that other Janus kinase inhibitors that have been long on the market for systemic treatment, such as ruxolitinib, were now developed as topicals. And the data we have seen from those clinical trials were quite promising, and they have shown efficacy not only in atopic dermatitis, also in other diseases such as vitiligo. And that's something I would also like to share with you, that I was impressed to see data with Janus kinase inhibitors in vitiligo. And for me, an even more important area was alopecia areata. And Matthias, what is your impression about those?
No, I think both have patients with a very high need for treatment. We don't have any licensed drugs for any of the two, but promising data both with the topicals like ruxolitinib, but also the systemics. And just off-label, we have used JAK inhibitors on both indications, and especially in alopecia areata, they are really effective. And so we need approval and then official on-label chance of treatment. But of course, there are many more new drugs coming up also for atopic dermatitis. If we talk about the systemics, there are, as inventions, the CCR4 inhibitors, OX40 ligand antibodies, which were presented. Do you think that we will have such a the run and dynamic development of new drugs in atopic dermatitis as we have seen in psoriasis in the past decade?
I think the run is even more pronounced right now in atopic dermatitis, and that may be due to the fact that we as psoriasis people in the past have paved the ground for this development. I don't know if all the new drugs that are currently developed for atopic dermatitis will actually make it to a treatment success. And you just mentioned the CCR4 inhibitors. This is particularly interesting to me from a, let's say, immunological perspective, because this could change the course of disease, because the mechanism of action is a clear immunomodulation and not just an inhibition of pathways. And the very early data that have been shown here for me are the most promising ones. And for the others, we just need to see the data of the phase 2 and the phase 3 program respectively, and then judge what the positioning in a potential scenario of treatment management will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the need is there in all indications we discussed, and even in psoriasis, I think there still is space for refinement and for also, new discoveries on maybe even better ease of use of the drugs, if not more effectiveness and safety. So I think we have covered a lot of new data and insights from the EADV. Uli, shall we stop here at the moment?
Yeah, Matthias and dear colleagues, thanks for listening. That's all about we have time for, unfortunately. And I would like to thank you, Matthias, for joining me here today and for the really entertaining and interesting discussion as we explored the highlights of the EADV 2021. We hope everyone listening enjoyed this as much as we did. And we hope to see everyone in person very soon. And thanks and take care.
Thank you, Uli.
And that is it for today's episode, everyone. I hope you found this overview of some of the highlights from EADV 2021 as informative as I did. If this episode interested you, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, just so you don't miss the next one. We have new episodes out every Friday. Meanwhile, be safe. And stay well. Goodbye for now.